Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host Laura Chen Baker and Bianca Bremham.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the James Terrell Sky Space that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, it's the final episode of our fourth season.
Fourth season.
Jeez. We're going through our open tabs, and we'll be discussing the dark side of the force, the omnipresent MailChimp rebrand, and smart museums. Ooh. As we do once a month, we're taking our furlough to New York, where we are joined by North American managing agent and producer Bianca Bremham. Bianca, hello. How are you?
You know, I'm kind of in the wars at the moment.
What's going on?
I was walking to the subway station to get to work and got distracted by this one brownstone's highly elaborate Halloween display and managed to trip headfirst over a tree branch.
Oh, shit.
Spill my coffee, land on my hands and hips. So I'm kind of hurting. My hand especially stings quite bad today.
I dropped a dumbbell on my finger this morning. I'm feeling pain.
Well, that sounds worse.
That was gross.
Bianca, how excited are you to spend Halloween with me together in Big Sur?
I'm so excited. What's our theme? Like, do we have a costume? Are we doing pop culture Halloween? Are we doing kind of like gothic ghoul Halloween?
Just doing our annual bloodletting Wiccan ritual where we, you know, pray to the advertising gods for another bountiful year of many rewards and infinite secrets.
And chant
every year. But in all seriousness, this is the last episode of our fourth season. It's been a wild ride. We're at number 60, which, yeah. Laura, how do you feel about it? You feeling good? You ready to do another 60?
You know it, Jeremy.
Super high energy.
I've done all my research.
Morning.
I'm ready.
But yeah, after this week, we will be taking a fortnight break where we will pause, consider our sins, think about the future, and just kind of prepare again for
That's
the last
a lie.
Run.
It's going to be 2 weeks will be gone in a flash.
That's
and we'll
true.
Be right back in here.
Anyway, if there's anything that you want us to cover specifically in the next season, we would really love to hear from you. Drop us a line at podcast@jackiewinter.com. We welcome and we'll look at all feedback. We promise. Okay. So we're going to
sincere.
We really will. We really want you to write us. We're just very lonely.
I'm so lonely.
Laura, get us started with the first link of the week, why the dark side of the force had to be dark. Where did you find this, by the way? I'm seeing a lot of stuff from Medium this week. I think 2 out of 3 posts from Medium.
Yeah, I found it on Medium, but it is actually a Nautilus article. It's written by Jim Davies. It just came up in my RSS. Jeremy, I know you have some sort of intense issues around dealing with color. And I had been tasked the last sort of week or so with coming up with a color palette for a side project that you and I are working on. And it had me thinking about color and the connotations that come with colors in a way that I can no longer tell if I'm just overthinking everything or not thinking things through enough. So when this link came up in my RSS, I thought it could be an interesting bit of fluff for us to chat about. And as you said, it's titled Why the Dark Side of the Force Had to Be Dark. And it's basically a look at the innate meanings of different colors and the relationships that we have with them. So at the beginning of the piece, he quotes various studies that aimed to demonstrate the psychological effects of colors. There was one that found that soccer players perceive red-shirted opponents to be better players. Another that found that players wearing red shirts won sports games more often. Yet another that found that red enhances performance on detail-oriented tasks. It really seems like red can do a lot. And as well, another that found that men find women wearing red to be more attractive and that women think the same of men. Though I don't know that I've ever seen
men wearing
red. Is
that why Valentine's Day is red?
There's a whole lot of things that go into this. But like, B, have you ever seen a man wearing red and been like, ooh,
damn.
Hubba, hubba. I don't think I've ever said hubba, hubba in my life. There you go. But yeah. Anyway, all of this led me down a little bit of a rabbit hole, as my articles often do. I was reading various sort of research papers and other articles on the sort of cultural relevance of certain colors, and it's pretty fascinating territory. I also read so many weird websites that claimed to explain the meanings of colors and how and why they should be used in design and branding. Yeah, it's actually kind of insane how many websites are dedicated just to breaking down color. It's crazy. Not even color theory, but more like psychology of color. It's very strange. I think the most interesting thing I took from all of this is the weird dichotomy between the fact that color is both something that has these sort of proven instinctual effects on our psychology and emotions, in effect making those reactions a somewhat universal human trait. And then at the same time, color is also something that is so incredibly tied to personal experience that the idea that any one color can generate a sort of consistent a hyper-specific emotion across all sorts of people is nuts. And I guess what I'm interested in is how much of our reaction to color is innate, some sort of inbred trait that we're born with, and how much is shaped by our environment, sort of nature versus nurture, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, you know, how much can we actually control when we make decisions about what colors to use in commercial projects? Before we keep going, Jeremy, I want us to therapize you. Why do you feel so uncomfortable about color? What happened in your childhood?
This is one of those things that, again, on the surface, like, seems like a really fluffy article, but gets into such kind of deep things, like you say. And I think color has so many kind of different implications in terms of, I guess, in terms of harmony as well. Like, I think putting colors together that work and that are kind of on trend. We talked about millennial pink, you know, and mm-hmm. kind of color implications on project the other week. And I kind of feel, you know, there's also this cliche about designers and architects just kind of always wearing black and kind of that uniform as well, in terms of it being kind of an easy thing. But also it has a lot of other implications that, you know, I don't think we can get into. But like, even when you look at kind of things like race, in terms of like what is kind of, you know, considered this purity and impure, and how can that create kind of more systematic things and like racism, for example. So
why do you always say that you're bad with color?
I say I'm bad with color because like I feel that to get, especially when you're thinking about color as a design element, I think it requires things kind of working in a certain kind of harmony. And I think because colors have lots of associations as well, like I kind of with things, like for me it's like sport teams, for example, like, you know, they have kind of specific colors, and sometimes it's like I'll love a specific set but just reminds me of kind of that sport team, for example. Or sometimes it's like a brand, for example, like, you know, it's like, oh yeah, it looks exactly this, like these are the Cheetos colors, we can't use this kind of on our website.
And I mean, that's what Cheetos are aiming for as well, is that but to be recognized by their colors.
Oh, exactly. And you know, colors is a huge
trademarked,
you know,
Cadbury purple
or Yves Klein blue, people who can, like, you know, or try to kind of copyright a certain kind of color and or the use of that color. So it's a huge kind of branding element. And I think that's kind of, we'll talk about this more kind of in the next piece as well. But yeah, the more kind of ownership people have on kind of certain colors, the harder it is to kind of find like where your niche is. And you have to get a lot more subtlety in the color and to create these kind of unique combinations, which I just find is really difficult.
Totally. I get it. Some of the things that I found kind of interesting was going right back to the basics. Like there are sort of basic things that research shows, such as, you know, how like exposure to light in the morning and like blue green light in particular prompts that release of the hormone cortisol, which stimulates and wakes us, and it inhibits the release of melatonin. And then in the late evening is the amount of blue light in sunlight sort of is reduced, which is why they say the blue light in screens is sort of bad right before bed.
Terrible.
Exactly. Melatonin's released back into the bloodstream and we become drowsy. So there's these sorts of things, you know, our biological sensitivities to various wavelengths of light that form the sort of basis of color psychology theories. And there is some established physiological mechanism through which color and light to some extent can affect our mood, our heart rate, our alertness, etc. One crazy thing I read about was that in 2009, blue lights were installed at the end of platforms on Tokyo's Yamanote railway line to reduce the incidence of suicide. And as a result, suicides fell by 74% at stations where the blue lights were installed. But again, you know, that's a crazy stat and it has obviously some impact reading that or hearing that. But without knowing more about the situation, for example, I was thinking like, okay, was there PR around this that perhaps had a greater effect than the blue light itself? You know, it's hard to know what sort of conclusions we can draw. And these steps, they were taken based on the claim that blue light can make people less impulsive and more calm. There's various studies that have looked to prove that. But there is kind of little consistent scientific evidence to really support these claims. And I think there are certain things that we can conclude fairly logically, like the fact that blood is red might make us associate red with violence, or because leaves are green, we associate green with nature. But it is interesting to distinguish between these sorts of associations and those that are created by marketers or by cultural norms.
I don't know. I think the nature connection is really the purest kind of one there. Like I think you could think about every association kind of comes from nature kind of in that way. Like I was reading about Buddhist robes, for example, in terms of why they're kind of red and just because of the...
Aren't they orange?
Yeah, kind of like an orange, like a saffrony, like some are red and kind of some are orange, but it kind of came because of the pigment that was kind of in the nature at the time. And that kind of has gone on to create this huge kind of cultural significance of what that color means. Or even if you look at something like, you know, dark nights and stormy clouds, of things being kind of like, you know, and getting, you know, more negative emotions stirred up to what a clear sky
is. But there are also lots of examples about how sort of vastly colors can be, sort of how vastly differently colors can be interpreted in different parts of the world. Like one example that always comes up is like purple is often associated with sort of royal royalty, wealth, nobility, etc., and sort of in the West. But in Brazil and Thailand, purple is the color of mourning. And then like yellow, a color that might make us feel cheery and warm. And we think like, oh, that's a natural association because of the sun and because of whatever. But in France, it signifies jealousy and betrayal. And,
but again, that it could be, you know, because of a thing from nature as well. Because, you know, the reason purple was the color of royalty because it was very rare in those kind of places.
Absolutely. So what's interesting though is that like, even though to some extent we see the same nature, we don't necessarily interpret those things in the same way. Like the French one, like in 10th century France, they painted the doors of traitors and criminals yellow so that they would be known to the community. And that's because it was a bright color people could see. But this sort of laid the foundation for these later associations. But at the same time, I'm sure there are lots of other portions of French history where yellow has been used in completely different ways. And surely that also forms part of the cultural understanding of yellow as well. I think just like in looking at all of these studies, it became pretty clear that none of this is as straightforward as the clickbaity articles want you to believe. And I think in the studies, the methodology they use is often really flawed, I guess, like a lot of studies. And they often take these really, really small causal relationships, potentially causal relationships, and they translate them to much bigger contexts. And then that's taken by some writer and used even more broadly. And then we end up with these websites that tell us that, you know, purple means sophisticated and yellow means happy. Or as I actually read somewhere last night, that red and green together are the colors of pain. So there you go. There's just so much conflicting reporting about the conclusive or not conclusive nature of these studies. And I think what I gathered from it is that we don't really know definitively what certain colors do and why. And I guess despite all of this, it is undeniable that brands do use color in a pretty consistent way to signify sort of different associations. And that definitely plays a role in how we perceive different colors and how that affects our experience in the world. And Bianca, I wanted to hear from you. I mean, what do you think about this? Do you think color has a significant impact in how we interpret the world around us?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I mean, light and dark, definitely. It's just, you know, it's not to be obvious, but it's just turned fall here in New York. The days are getting shorter, and it's the fact that it's now dark before I leave the office is having a huge impact on my mood. And I think that our bodies and minds are affected by color in the same way. Like I couldn't imagine, you know, like sitting in a room that with blue light, like how much that's going to affect me and perhaps affect my decisions compared to being outside in the natural light. And yeah, I definitely think that that has an overflow into how we see the world and how we might make decisions about things that we like or things that we want to bring into our lives.
Yeah, I'm interested in hearing more from you about that, Bianca, because as we joked about in our initial segment, James Turrell is a particular artist that you love and he works with color in such an interesting way. But also one of the things that I'm surprised wasn't brought up in this piece was Edward de Bono's Six Thinking Hats. Are you guys all familiar with that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You know what? I've never read the entire book, so I have no idea what the color association is.
We were taught about it in primary school, weirdly enough.
Primary school?
Yeah.
It's a big thing that, you know, we kind of
I went
through
to a weird Montessori school.
Yeah, I was going to say you went to a progressive school.
Yeah.
But basically, they use kind of six colored hats as metaphors for kind of different directions of kind of thinking. And so, like, you know, you metaphorically put on the black hat and now you're kind of, you know, you're in
a magician.
Exactly.
And the white hat, you're about to make a meal.
Very funny, everyone. I'm just trying to make a serious point. I'm completely derailed at the moment. Anyway, you put on a different color hat and that just kind of is a way for you to kind of get into a different kind of thinking mode, basically. But obviously, colors, color theory, color forecasting, you know, Pantone has made an entire kind of business out of this in terms of defining different kind of colors of the year. And that has a huge run-on effect to what's actually happening in commerce at the moment. And I've even noticed as well, one of my favorite Photoshop tools, just the hue slider. Sometimes as well, like you can bring in, I've done this before, like with an artist doing a folio review and kind of say like, hey, just notice how you move this hue slider. Your artwork just went from 1998 to 2020. You know, like there are certain kind of color schemes and kind of things that just can...
Wouldn't take advice from you. You're bad with color.
You know what? I know it when I see it, though. I would like to defend myself there.
Well, I'm just wondering as well, like, I think when it comes to, I want to know when it comes to like packaging and stuff like that, like, do you think, or how much do you think color impacts your sort of purchasing decisions? And like, because of that, do you think that designers should be limited to using a certain range of colors because that's what's going to make people buy?
Well, I can give you some actual evidence here because I used to work in a packaging design studio and we had used to have a fake supermarket set up on the kind of top floor. And so all the other products that were in that kind of category were set up there. And then every time we would do kind of a mock-up, we would kind of see how it looks. And it's a very deliberate attempt that brands use, which is called color blocking, which they look at all the other kind of colors that are in the same kind of space, the shelf space. And they literally try to put, you know, they try to block out our product or the one that we were doing kind of in a single color there. And I think that's a very, you know, that's a...
As in something contrasting?
Well, I think like watching the September issue, I think the documentary about the Vogue September magazine, I think they do a similar thing. in magazines.
Oh yeah, they do it in every kind of industry. And I think, you know, what's always interesting to me as well, like I have one of my bookshelves, like I kind of sit in my library at home and there's always one book that just kind of pops out from all the other books. And like, it's no, like, you know, it's not a great design or anything. It's just that kind of configuration of books and where it sits.
If everyone's doing the same thing, how do any of them stand out?
Well, this is the thing. I think it's always a response. You know, someone's always going to kind of outdo something, and there's always advances in technology as well. People use different, especially in packaging, they do these things. Like, I don't know if you saw, like, remember when Big M kind of did it where you could spell kind of something out. And so like you get kind of more shelf space in a design sense. But yeah, color's a huge, huge part of that. But I think, yeah, I don't know.
I just think like it's silly to restrict like organic products need to be green and brown and I don't know, tech products need to be blue, and it just feels restrictive. But anyway.
For some reason, I think sometimes it's like immediate association. Like I was talking to someone the other day, and there's definitely, as an Australian living in New York, there's words that I say in America just to make it so much easier to communicate in this city. Like I'll say vacation, I'll say to stay or to go.
College.
I pronounce it tomato, not tomato. I say pepper, not cucumber. Just sorry, not
pepper.
Pepper, not capsicum.
you're gonna get the wrong thing, mate.
And I have the wrong salad. But just to make communication more efficient. And I think that sometimes is it easier to just make those quick associations, and then perhaps it's someone that is coming in and doing something, disrupting it and doing it a little bit different that is going to really get cut through.
B, let's close it out. What's your favorite color?
I mean, it's tough. Like if we're talking clothing and what I choose to wear every single day, you know, 90% of the people that I am around would probably say that I'm obsessed and I love black and it's my favorite color ever. But like you said before, like I think that like, you know, I don't know if it's my favorite because I'm choosing to wear it for many reasons beyond the aesthetic, which is, you know, mostly kind of to do with decision fatigue. So I don't know. I'm definitely drawn to bolder, brighter colors, but really only when they're displayed on their own. I don't know.
Jeremy, what's your favorite color?
Yeah, like it's black. It just works. I think the thing is I love color and like I love, and sometimes I buy things that just, I really like buying colorful things, but then I end up feeling just, I don't know, like maybe it's kind of just the fact that I feel so exposed wearing kind of bright colors, you know? But yeah, no, I want to go with it. And I'll also kind of point out that Anish Kapoor, who we talked about a few podcast episodes ago, who made that black hole that someone fell into, is yes. Actually got an exclusive rights to a blacker black. So the black is...
Oh, the black is black. That video black comes up on my Facebook sort of scrolly thing all the time. My favorite color changes all the time. I think like I do have a favorite color at the moment. And well, for quite a while, it's been that sort of like calm, kind of dull olive green. But I hated green as a child. So I don't know. These things change.
They do indeed. Well, look, we'll put the link up and we'd love to hear what your favorite color is. What do you want to do when you grow up? Where do you see yourself in 5 years? Tell us all these things. What do you want to see in the podcast next season? Email us, podcast@jackiewinter.com. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll move on from here. The second link of the week is from myself. Much like the Banksy piece we discussed last week, there was no way we could finish the season without going into the much-discussed MailChimp rebrand. A few weeks ago, without any warning, MailChimp users were welcomed with a pretty radical overhaul, a new typeface and color scheme, plus a new wordmark, and a whole suite of what I call nouveau weird illustrations made for a pretty big leap in a very closely held and highly regarded brand, especially in the creative community. Now, look, there are many puff pieces written on the exercise, and I thought I'd return to Old Faithful, brand new, part of the Under Consideration family, to try to get in some more background and community response. But I was surprised in general that this seemed to be pretty much the deepest design critique I could find for this rebrand. Like, I know, like, I just think there's so many of them kind of coming out at the moment. I don't know if you guys were around when Emigre magazine was around, but like, you know, this, it was, well, it eventually kind of came a book and a journal. They were also Type Foundry, but, you know, it was a great source for kind of really kind of deep discourse in this, you know, in the design space. But right now, you know, rebrands are just happening so often, kind of so fast. And I feel really the only kind of research that, or the only kind of response that can happen is our basic reporting that this has kind of happened and people's kind of comments. I like it. I don't like it. I don't know. It doesn't really scratch my itch for that deeper conversation that way. And I feel like so many of these rebrand projects are done just to make these amazing case study pages. Did you guys see the recent Uber one, for example? I mean, beautiful, beautiful case study. It's like so many elements animating in all these different like picture perfect worlds.
More time on the case study than on the road.
Well, there's definitely kind of something to that. But like, you know, John Westenberg, who was on the podcast last week, I mean, he had pretty scathing words for this. And for me and for Uber, all it really made me have to do was kind of relearn where the app was on my phone.
That's
basically.
So true.
But no, that, I mean, but that's the case for, yeah, that was happening with me as well. So look, Lara B, I'd really like to get your feedback on this. You know, the case study on the Collins site, and Collins is just kind of, I mean, they're smashing it, but I think there is a lot of kind of homogeneity kind of in terms of how they're approaching these rebrands as well. Like, you know, they were responsible for the Dropbox rebrand as well, which I want to kind of come back to in a different way. But they say that the rebrand is an evolution. It retains all the elements that endeared the brand to its first fervent fans while creating space for MailChimp to grow and speak with greater authority to a wider audience. So from what I can see on the surface, there wasn't any kind of really huge kind of need to do this. I mean, apart from the fact that it just seemed like it was time. I mean, MailChimp is someone who's very active in the creative community. I don't think you can listen to a podcast without kind of hearing a MailChimp ad in that kind of way. They seem to sponsor every kind of event, every kind of website, etc. So I guess I want to throw it back to you guys. Like, do you think this was necessary? And if so, does it accomplish its goal? B, what do you reckon?
I mean, I find it really difficult to objectively comment on rebrands for products or services that I don't actually use. Like, does it accomplish its goal? I have no clue, because I don't think that I'm the market for a service that allows me to send out newsletters, because I'm not sending out newsletters. That being said, though, I mean, I could honestly say that like MailChimp is the only service of this kind that I'm actually aware of. So they've obviously done like an okay job up until now of targeting people like me who do work in the creative industry. But, you know, it, like, at the same time, like, as you said, it's difficult to listen to a podcast and not hear about MailChimp. So for me, it's hard to separate whether the brand recognition has come from the way that MailChimp have manifested their brand visually, or because of the fact that for the last couple of years, it seems like they have sponsored almost every creative event or conference or podcast on the planet, including Creative Mornings, which we're very close to here at Jackie Winter, considering you're the Melbourne chapter host, Jeremy. I find it really difficult to comment objectively.
Well, that's the thing. It's like MailChimp is really baked into kind of culture in this really unique way. And I think that's an obvious kind of intention of what they're trying to do. They've also expanded their services greatly as well. I mean, we use MailChimp for retargeting marketing, for example. They do landing pages, e-commerce ads, everything. So I do think that because their products have evolved, maybe it was a good time to make sure that they updated their messaging and everything. And but yeah, the way that they kind of, you know, for example, they got Jessica Hish to redo their logo last time. And so that was kind of very smart, because not only did they get a great new logo, they get this whole kind of content marketing piece about engaging Jessica and working with her in that way, getting this kind of process piece out of it too. Laura, did you have any takes on this at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's, when you ask about sort of does it accomplish its goals, I agree. It's a hard question to answer without knowing MailChimp's sort of numbers or their business objectives. But, you know, I'm guessing there did have to be more to the rebrand than simply wanting a bit of a refresh. And I do see why they wanted to shift things up. I think, firstly, I do have to say I'm such a huge, huge, huge fan of their brand personality in general. I think the way that they run their business is pretty incredible, at least from what you see on the outside. And I think that has to come from the inside as well. In particular, I mean, any copywriter will have been at some point sort of sent the MailChimp copy guidelines and stuff, because they've made them public and they're incredible. Like, they're just an incredible set of guidelines, and they've put so much thought into the way that they speak and communicate with their audience. And it's awesome. I think for a lot of people, it's become a real example of how to build a brand in a really friendly, in a really good way, in a, not just friendly, but in a way that really spoke just to the people that they were targeting and really focused on them. And yeah, I mean, I've always loved what they've done. So it's like kind of jarring for me to see them shift, because I worry that we're going to lose some of that, you know, the beautiful touches that I've loved in MailChimp for so long. And again, I don't really necessarily use MailChimp myself that much. I have on occasion on behalf of Jackie Winter, like back in the day, I sort of would send out the newsletter and stuff like that. But otherwise, like, what I appreciate about them so much has been like their general, their comms when emails end up coming to our info inbox or whatever, or other sort of things that they might put out, whether it's like research pieces or their guidelines and stuff like that. And also, I do appreciate all the things that they sponsor and that they support.
Yeah, the support of the creative community, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. I've always sort of kept MailChimp in quite sort of high regard in that way. So I guess, yeah, first off, I have to say, like, I don't hate it, but I don't necessarily get it, the update. But I'm not mad about it. I take it back. I'm mad. The only thing I'm mad about is the new word mark, I think. Like, something about it just makes me, like, I think it's the oval dots on the eyes. Like, they make me so uncomfortable.
Yeah, like, I mean, and I want to kind of talk about this more when we kind of come to the comments, but like, I wonder how much of that was a deliberate approach, because what I'm kind of seeing in terms of wordmark branding, it's like you have people that are just kind of doing them in the fashion space. Like, you have Celine and who's the other, Burberry,
other Burberry. Yeah, Burberry,
you know, and even Calvin Klein, all three of them kind of going to these just very basic kind of sans serif
Times New Roman.
and I think that you either just do a slight evolution and you're going to get kind of panned, or people are going to say it's classical, or you do something a bit weird and people say they don't kind of like it. You know, you can't make everyone happy. We'll go back to the comments later, but let's talk about the one aspect that we do probably have the most ability to comment on, which is the illustration. I mean, illustration's always been a huge part of the MailChimp brand. I mean, the logo is like Freddy the Chimp, like his face, like has always been a huge part of it, that kind of vector style that kind of came out at the same time around Firefox did their rebrand when we talked about it the other month, like kind of that really rich detail, the kind of dimensional contained space. But yeah, I wasn't surprised to kind of see the direction they went here in terms of this new trend of kind of very kind of not strange, but more kind of surreal, more kind of, I guess, maybe even South American kind of infused black and white illustrations. And I think that that's a huge kind of contrast to what they had before, which is all kind of this kind of vector stuff. And I wouldn't be surprised if, like their previous brand, that kind of sparks off a million copycats who go kind of in this direction as well. But I'm kind of curious, like, you know, at the speed of which kind of things are turning over lately, do you think illustration is still a viable mean to give brands unique voices? I thought it was really interesting as well, because you look at Collins, who did the Dropbox rebrand, and in the same week, I won't kind of talk about this link, but Dropbox kind of dropped this totally new aesthetic, and like, which was kind of this like sci-fi kind of collage thing, like very kind of photo based as well. So I kind of think there is a kind of a certain competing element where everything's always a reaction to kind of against something else. Like, you know, when Google came out with their material design language, you saw this geometric vector stuff happening everywhere. And now we're seeing a lot of kind of emerging new styles. Pitch.com, another business, was doing kind of these 3D characters. Now we have MailChimp in this kind of sketchy mode. So I'm really kind of seeing a fissure here that things are starting to break out. But what do you think? Do you think illustration and tech will kind of remain together for the future, or are we seeing kind of a change at the moment?
It's funny because I think we can agree that across illustration in all commercial spaces, there's definitely been like a rebound off that flat geometric vector sort of style you're talking about. There's been like, there was like that we're going faster and faster and faster and faster towards that. And then we sort of hit a wall and we bounced back. And now everyone wants things to, and I think it's a reaction to sort of larger things in society as well, that people want to see messy and they want to see loose and they want to see handmade and they want to, you know, kind of moving away from technology and moving away from those things. But obviously we still use technology and all the things that we see and consume it are founded in sort of screens and, you know, all that stuff. So it's kind of like the meshing of those two things has been sort of interesting to see, but not surprising. And I think that's kind of exactly what's happening here. You asked, like, I mean, do you think is illustration still a viable means to give brands unique voices? And I think, you know, of course, I'm biased, but of course I do. But of course, it's only, you know, if that's brandished in the right way. And I think it is tricky because, of course, brands want to be unique, but you still need to be consumable by the audience. And that means sort of being recognizable in some way that allows them to sort of put you into that box that they can understand and interact with. And that sort of comes back to the conversation we're having about color before as well, and those associations with color. So you kind of end up in this weird territory sometimes where you kind of have here with the MailChimp rebrand, where the company is sort of trying to do things differently to other tech/digital companies, but they're also trying to appeal to a broad audience and still be sort of understood. And I actually really like the illustration style they've used here. Like, I'm all for it. The one thing that really bothered me and that feels kind of off is that if you read through their page on it, the actual MailChimp page on it, they do sort of outline, because I was wondering this, it really weirded me out. They did use a range of different artists, but they all have very similar styles. But of course, because they're different people, they're not the same. So the effect that you get is that they all kind of match, but also just kind of slightly don't. And it made it feel a little bit sloppy to me. I wish they'd just used one artist and kept it consistent, or instead used a range of like very clearly different styles. But the way they've done it just makes, I don't know, it was weird. It was like they had one artist that they really liked and really wanted, and then that person couldn't finish the whole job. And so they like brought in other random people to do it and try and imitate the style. It just, I don't know. Did you get that feeling?
Well, I think that the illustration style that they have come up with is definitely fresh, and it's executed especially well in motion. But I think part of me does wonder about its longevity. And I think, like, as you were saying, Jeremy, before, like, I'll confess that I haven't really read too many case studies about this overhaul because they don't really exist. So I'm not sure if this has been addressed, but I wonder whether the decision to actually commission a number of different artists and different voices is a way to perhaps combat how quickly illustration trends and our tastes are actually moving. Like, perhaps they've left a little bit of room for...
But they've all got the same style.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a little bit of room to move there. Like, I think that there's a bit of difference.
Yeah, and I think there's also the fact that these bigger brands are turning over kind of so much content as well. They sometimes need to make sure that they're spread across multiple artists to get that stuff frequently. And we've had that feedback from a few different kind of client jobs we're working on. But I do agree that it is a bit dangerous because my advice to artists has always been make sure like you're in your own kind of unique territory. And so like if five artists can be part of one rebrand that kind of feels cohesive, I mean, yes, there's some great art direction involved there. But yeah, it's risky in terms of, I guess, what kind of message that's kind of sends to artists as well, like, and in terms of how stable it will make your career if you know that you are kind of going to be interchangeable with somebody else in that style as well.
I just have to say, this is not on this exactly the same topic, but I've just realized something. So I'd never heard of Brand New before, that you where you got this link from,
and I just felt like,
what an amazing name. Brand New, because it's a new brand. Brand New.
First of all, okay, there's so many things that pick apart there. We're going to do that when we were off mic.
So I wanted to go really quickly back to your original question, Jeremy, as to whether illustration is still a viable means to give brands unique voices, because I'm curious to hear your opinion on it. Because my initial and honest reaction to illustration being used in rebrands, like this one in particular, is that the illustration generally feels better suited to something more temporary, like a launch campaign, rather than really as part of the bedrock of the brand's voice. And although it is hard for me to speak objectively because I'm very aware of how heavily influenced my opinion is by the fact that I work in illustration and I see how quickly it moves, and because of the amount of illustration that I'm exposed to on a daily basis. But
here, I have a very controversial opinion here, which is it works if you're going to really invest in it. And that's the reason why I think it worked for MailChimp, because they went whole hog into it, or whole monkey, or whatever other animal thing you want to kind of put. But no, I mean, you know, Freddy was a huge part of that brand. And like from the illustration of Freddy came the toy of Freddy. And that was such a huge part about kind of getting those toys and then taking that into the style of kind of animation, the finger pressing the button where you're about to kind of send something. Like, you guys may not have seen that, but this is amazing animation where when you're about to send the campaign, it's got Freddy's finger hovering over a big red button, and then you push and get to send it. Like, that's an amazing feeling. But that kind of took real commitment from them to say, okay, we're using illustration, we're using humor, and this is going to be our brand. And I think the problem is when you actually look at things in a superficial way that, yeah, we're only going to use the illustration for the launch and we're only going to use the illustrator in this way, and not really kind of considering, yeah, who the illustrator is that you're going to use and how you can create kind of a whole aesthetic world around that. So I think it is viable if people are really going to invest in it. And I think that goes for any kind of form of commercial art within a brand. So
definitely.
Lots to pick apart there. And I really hope there's some more kind of deeper pieces written on this in the coming months, because yeah, it's a real interesting exercise. And yeah, I will just kind of close out on the comments section in Brand New, because I would love to see just kind of some more actual kind of some just deeper thought on these things. The one thing I did get one interesting thing out of the comments, which somebody was talking about, and I kind of thought this was maybe, you know, a bit ridiculous like at first reading, but then I thought like, someone said about like whether we're going to start looking at like animals in logos as kind of something that we might kind of not want to do, or there's kind of a certain amount of kind of inhumanity there because there's effectively a severed monkey's head as this kind of
logo. Yeah, whether an organization like PETA might take issue with the fact that they're using an animal in their logo. That honestly, I read that and I didn't even get any further.
Yeah, look, I didn't get any further, but I think, I mean, it was an interesting point. It was an interesting thing to think about that I didn't think about before. I mean, obviously people would have a field day if that was kind of something that was actually kind of considered. But overall, I didn't really get any kind of thing further from these comments. I'm not even sure why they existed. Do you find the comments here useful at all?
I mean, I love reading comment sections because they're just terrible, terrible little caves of humanity. But my favorite, I always have my favorite comment, is just very simple this week. Very chimpy.
Very chimpy indeed.
Or if I was going to leave a comment, I bloody love the yellow.
Oh, I love the yellow. Love the yellow.
Funny enough, for the woman who loves black, a bit of yellow. Excellent. Thank you everyone for your feedback. And I think we will move on to our final link from here. Bianca, here you are again, closing off the season, bringing a bit of culture back to our filthy backwater of Australia into this piece on smart museums, another Medium piece. Tell us about this. What are smart museums?
Well, this is a link that Lara actually posted into our internal professional development Slack channel. I have no clue, Lara, where you found it. Do you remember?
It would have been on my RSS again.
Yeah. So it's hosted on Medium and was published by a guy called Dan De Goose. I'm 100% butchering his name. Apologies. It's a bit of a hypothetical exploration on how making a museum smart by utilizing advanced technologies such as the Internet of Things, which is an interesting term that I don't think I'd heard of before.
The IoT.
IoT, yes. Facial recognition cameras and biometric sensors could positively enhance a museum's way of conducting business, boost visitor experience, and perhaps even increase its impact on society. He sets up his exploration by first outlining how museums currently do business. So a museum's success is generally measured by the annual number of visitors and its annual revenues. So the more visitors you attract, the more revenue is generated. So it's in the museum's best interests to ensure that they attract as many visitors as possible. And one way they do this is first by investing in both the museum's permanent collection as well as their rotation of, you know, new and exciting temporary exhibitions to encourage repeat visits throughout the year. So you need great work to attract visitors. And he poses the question, how can technology contribute to creating the ultimate collection with the purpose of enhancing the museum's business? And to do this, he kind of brings up and presents a couple of different metrics, the first being an art attention score, which would use technology to rate the performance of an individual piece of art based on the level of attention it manages to capture from the museum visitors, mostly by using location tracking technologies. And then an art emotion score, which goes even further to apply facial recognition technology to be sure that a visitor is paying attention to a piece of art rather than using just their location to guess. So it's pretty long, this article, so I'm not going to go into too much detail, but a big part of the exploration.
Come on, this is like a quarter of the length of the ones I normally send you guys.
Yeah. It was pretty deep. But a big part of his exploration, especially around assigning an art attention score, is based on the assumption that a visitor visits an exhibition with a certain curiosity and or expectation. The idea is that the longer a piece of art holds the visitor's attention, the more it meets or contradicts this curiosity or expectation, and the more important the piece of art is to the museum's collection. Do you guys agree?
Jeremy, who's going first?
I mean, I don't know if I can answer those exact questions per se. Like, I think it's interesting to consider among something like the Museum of Old and New York, Mona. Like, have both of you guys been?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess...
No.
You haven't, really?
I have never, no. Spoiler alert.
I think they were one of the first museums like to really fully integrate a kind of digital experience. Like, so you get like, well, it wasn't iPod Touch. I don't know what it is at the moment, but you would get like kind of an iOS device that had an app on it, actually developed by this really great company I'll link to here called Art Processors, which kind of, that's kind of their business at the moment. They're trying to figure out how to get these experiences kind of into galleries. And I think I just find it's interesting, like with our cultural experiences, we always want to have that kind of second layer of information. So
do
it's like,
we though?
Well, how many times are you, like, this happens for me a lot. Like, for
but
example,
that's a second layer of information for the visitors, not for the museum.
Yep. Right.
That's a different thing that we're talking about here.
Is it though?
Yeah, it is different. This is talking about tracking what people are looking at and like tracking like how long they stare at a painting or how quickly they move through a space. Or,
right, you know. Right. Yeah, well, yeah, sorry. I was going to come around to that because I guess how you get that, I guess, would really kind of come from these tools though, right? Wouldn't they? I mean, it's interesting that this is not a new idea in any means in terms of how in terms of using kind of tech to kind of augment the gallery experience, like, you know, doing audio tours has been a thing since I was a kid. And that's now kind of stepping up. And now I guess galleries kind of getting your data and kind of being able to react to that in some ways. I don't like that kind of strikes me as kind of the darker side of that coin of having this kind of second layer of experience. So it's like going back to my previous point, which is like the new Siri, for example, the new Apple TV, it has this kind of function where you can turn on, I don't know if it's called X-ray or something else, but like basically, like if you want to kind of see, it's like, oh, who else was that actor? Like, what else was that actor? Mm. Like, I know I've seen them in something, and it'll tell you, or kind of like, or what else has this kind of person?
While you're watching a film.
While you're watching the film.
It's so hard to Google stuff.
And I think that's the, like, there's like this general need that when you're having a cultural experience, you want to kind of get more background. And so, well, if you're going to be kind of on your phones or on your devices kind of anyway, it makes sense for the gallery museum to kind of provide that. And then they get kind of data on top of it. But I kind of feel that that is like completely antithetical to what the art experience kind of should be. And surely galleries and museums should be like the last bastion where we can have kind of our attention kind of roam free and people able to make risky decisions kind of on the kind of art that's kind of shown and the experiences that they have based on, I guess, this primal experience that you have to kind of make art rather than data. So I guess, yeah, I don't know. Maybe
well,
this
that's
is
one
my...
of the things that he kind of like touches on is how an artist could potentially utilize the data that is generated by a museum. So perhaps like using facial technology, facial recognition technology to monitor a person's emotion as they're viewing a piece of art, or looking at like how long they're spending in front of a piece of art and what kind of their movements are around it. But
yeah, I could see this working for someone like Jeff Koons or someone like that, you know, who's really kind of asking those kind of questions and, you know, really looking at the hardcore commerciality of this. And I think it works. It would be a really interesting kind of exhibition, or, you know, maybe if it was kind of exploded to a gallery or space that just does this. But I think being in the kind of general sphere of culture is so dangerous.
I couldn't agree more.
But I completely disagree when we've talked about this for advertising, which is like, well, you know, they, when we talked about facial recognition built into billboards and like and changing the engagement on that, like, I don't know, for some reason, I feel it's okay there. This is not okay.
Well, because advertising is explicitly meant to be a manipulative, whereas this is art is meant to be sort of there for learning and for enjoyment. I mean, first thing, like the thing that kind of was funny, you mentioned the structure of the article at the beginning, Bianca, because like it was written exactly like a high school essay. Like it was like, you remember those templates? I don't know if you guys got this, and they would give you the little
in
boxes.
In this essay, I will argue.
Yes, exactly. So it's like first paragraph, state the argument. Second paragraph, outline how you're going to demonstrate that argument. Third paragraph, establish the context, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, look, I mean, I understand that businesses and for the most part, galleries and museums, they are businesses. They do need to do some sort of research to understand their customer base and to do well in their markets. But this sort of thing makes me very uncomfortable, I think, in how heavy the focus is on quantitative data instead of qualitative. I think that they're drawing conclusions that aren't necessarily true. I don't think that just because you might look at something for a short time that it's not then important to the flow of the gallery or providing part of the experience that people enjoy and need. And I guess one thing I did like in the piece, I didn't like most of the piece. One thing I did like was that they recognized that one use for this data may not be just, you know, saying that this piece is more popular than another because it's better, but rather, you know, maybe the reason people are spending more time in one part of the gallery is because the signage and wayfinding to that section is better, or the space it's in is nicer. And so it's sort of important to consider not just the art itself, but how you're displaying it, you know. And at one stage, they discuss how the artworks would need to be spaced within the room in order for sensors to pick up accurate data. And I guess it's here, though, that I do start to get quite uncomfortable, even more uncomfortable, because when I start to think about the idea of how data gathering could affect curating decisions, like those sorts of decisions, I think should be based on two things only. The first being, you know, the aesthetic effect that the artist and the curator want to deliver. And the second, just, you know, the ability of the viewer to see and enjoy the works, you know. And I worry that if these institutions are all using the same sort of algorithms to determine what artworks they showcase, then they'll all start to sort of homogenize, and we lose that beautiful thing that these spaces are so wonderful for, which is, you know, introducing us to things that we don't already love and things that we haven't necessarily seen before.
I guess, yeah. And my thing, I guess the final point I'll make on this as well is that art shouldn't always make you feel good, and not feeling good and feeling disengaged or bored or kind of feeling disgusted.
Like, I once had a visceral reaction to a Philip Glass ballet that no one around me could understand how physically uncomfortable that piece made me feel.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and that's what I think great art kind of should do. And I think there's, it's so interesting to know what kind of facial recognition can do and what facial functions can do and what kind of things that they can kind of, what they can give, what kind of feedback and data they can give by measuring them.
Yeah, for the sake of science, it's fascinating. But when it comes to sort of art spaces, I just think it feels like such an enormous invasion of privacy, don't you think? I mean, like, it's all interesting, and I can't lie, like, I would be absolutely fascinated to look at the data that came out of this. But it really all comes down to how that data is used and what sort of decisions that you let it inform. Like I touched on this a minute ago, but I just have to reiterate, like I think the world is already so dangerously becoming too alike. And I hate the idea of erasing our differences and these sorts of technologies, things that are already very much at play in a lot of the services that we use today. They go a long way towards doing that. And algorithms in social media already encourage us all to take the same holidays, to wear the same clothes, to use the same language. And I think
to photograph the same Jeff Koons, to photograph exactly. The same Jeff Clavin.
But the purpose of a gallery or museum should not be to appeal to the masses, but sort of the opposite, really, to celebrate the variety that we still have across cultures and across individuals.
Absolutely. Well, look, I think reaction gif here, old man shakes fist at cloud. You know, that's kind of what I feel.
But also, when are we installing this in our gallery?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Again, we will put all the links to this on our show notes at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz or our podcast specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter. If you want to catch up on any of these links or any of the previous seasons, that's where you go. But for now, we'll move on and we will wrap up like we do every week. And it is time for, drumroll please, the brilliantly named thumbs up / thumb down / shaka. The time we dedicate each week to the good, the bad, the completely petty off our chest. Lara, what do you have for us this week?
I have another thumbs up. Something's happened to me. I've got a thumbs up for, you guys must have seen Meet Grant by now.
No.
Yeah.
Meet Grant, the only man designed to survive a life in advertising. It's the spoof that Cummins and Partners did of the Clemenger Melbourne's Meet Graham campaign. So you know how Meet Graham, they partnered with Patricia Panini. I'm so bad with names.
Sorry.
Beautiful artist. They partnered with her to build a body that could survive a car crash, and it was an incredible campaign. But Cummins have done this sort of pretty hilarious spoof of it, and it's this spot where they sort of reveal the various characteristics you need to make it in advertising. So of course, a removable spine for client meetings, a smaller than average genitals, an extra liver, and of course Grant is a white male. It's really funny.
It's such a sick burn. It's such a sick burn.
It's harmless because that other campaign did so well and it was amazing, and this is just a really, really funny poke at that. They created it for the MADC Awards, but it's so funny. Go have a watch. We'll post a link, of course, and B, bloody watch it. It's funny.
B, what do you got?
My thumbs up. Jeremy, this time next week, you and I are hanging out.
Oh my God.
I'm super getting excited facials. About that. Yes, this time next week, we will be spending a week together, which is really exciting. As if you're a listener and you're not aware, we do live on opposite sides of the globe and we are meeting in the middle, which is very fun.
Not for the first time, though. That would be weird.
Yeah, that would be weird.
No, but I miss you. I'm very excited to spend a week with you.
Me too. Do you think we should do some kind of car episodes of the podcast? Like me and carpool karaoke?
Just you and I just chatting away.
Just chatting, maybe. I think we could do a great carpool karaoke. Yeah. Just the fun album, just me and you together, finally reunited.
Do you hear the people sing? I'm going to get some Les Mis in there.
And the mega mix of Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, of course. I also have a thumbs up for the week. Triple thumbs up once again. Cherry. My thumbs up is yet another podcast. This is a podcast I fortunately do not have to.
How dare you listen to any other podcast?
Yes. Well, this is a podcast that I fortunately do not have to listen to often, but it's called Sleep With Me. Are you guys familiar with this at all? So it's a podcast that specifically is designed to kind of put you to sleep. Yeah, I had a bit of a bout of insomnia for the last kind of week. And in addition to some wonderfully helpful drugs, I pulled out all the big guns and I had the podcast on last night, put me out within an hour, slept for around kind of 9 hours, woke up feeling fine. So
there was an interview with him on something like 99 Designs or something as well recently with the guy who runs Sleep With Me.
It's a bit weird because he tells these stories that kind of meander, that don't go anywhere. He repeats kind of certain
things.
Sounds
like my kind of stories.
Dick burn on yourself.
Anyway, if you're having trouble sleeping and you haven't already fallen asleep, listen to us yak on for the last 40 minutes. Give this a shot. It's called the Sleep With Me podcast. And I think that will do us for this week. Thank you. Be.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Laura.
No worries. Waves of fear were crashing down on me.
Okay, it is the last episode of the season. For the past 6 or 7 episodes, I've been doing speed runs. Somehow, through some miracle, I have been able to pull it off every week, beating my previous record. I don't know if this can really kind of continue to the next season. We might have to come up with something else.
Please don't let it continue.
Yes, I'm not going to let it continue. But look, whether or not I beat the previous records, whether or not I don't, it's been a good exercise. It's been a real kind of personal journey for me of growth and trying to match my listening speed of podcasts as well. So look, I don't know. I'm going to try my best. What is the time to beat, Laura?
The time to beat this week, get ready, Jeremy. It's 48 seconds, 15 milliseconds. Are you ready?
I have the additional challenge of having to include Bianca's name here as well.
Whew. Well, look, we wish you luck, and I can't wait to never do this again. Jeremy, I'm getting my clock ready.
Okay, count
me in. Are you ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1.
I'm Jeremy Wharton. She's Laura Tenbaker, and she's Bianca Brahim. This has been Jackie Winter, gives you the business. I think music about totally unrelated our company, Melbourne based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out stuff at soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more Jackie Winter, gives you the business. Archives of all the shows and links we can find can be covered on jackiewinter.gov.biz to receive all the links we talk about in the show each week. One neat little package. You can sign up to podcast specific newsletter tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. Jackie with the Y Winter like the season. You can hit us up any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing, rating, and leaving us a comment on iTunes. And of course, recommending us to all your mates as well as iTunes. They can get the show wherever you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, for the traditional direct from our website, Jackie Winter, I can give you the depth. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to the podcast using Podcast Overcast or Castro, you'll be able to see this. The articles, you'll be able to see the link to the articles as I talk about them, as well as other schmick visual content. As you grab knowledge, like, we're right there in the room with you. And if you work for an advertising agency or design student interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check us out. Open Tabs are ready for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye.
For fuck's sake, Jeremy, you smashed it.
What'd I do?
45.76. Jeremy, it's been a good run.
I'd like to thank my family. I'd like to thank my agents. I'd like to thank everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to this season. Again, email us with any feedback that you can. Do you listen to the show? What do you want to hear more of? What do you want to hear less of? podcast@jackiewinter.com. Again, the site is jackiewinter.gives you the .biz, tinyletter.com/jackiewinter. Thank you, everyone. Have a good little break. We'll catch you in a few weeks. Bye-bye. I don't know, like, maybe it's kind of just the fact that I feel so exposed wearing kind of bright colors, you know?
But
stop
exposing yourself.
Okay, I walked right into that, and that's fair enough. Straight to the blooper reel right there.